welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, there's a little chat room in there. But you know, what's interesting is chat rooms normally go off topic, and I kind of do as well. And I've found that what's interesting is that when you're doing conspiracy research or having conversations about it, staying quote-unquote on topic actually becomes almost an infrequent impossibility because of the many, many eclectic little thingies that come together in order to actually comprise said topic. And before I go to my guest, I just wanted to read out something my Facebook status this morning. I believe I will not be totally free from the various eclectic forms of choice restrictions we suffer until we're all free. The reason for my activism is not to free myself, nor my country. It's simply the right thing to do. I may never see a free world in my lifetime, but I am driven to do what's right regardless of my level of success. Demonize me, imprison me, poison me, kill me. It matters not. My rage and sense of injustice has now been inflamed and cannot be put out in this life or the next. Bring it on. That's the level of sacrifice I expect for everybody who wants to do something worthwhile in this movement. Speaking of people who do something worthwhile, my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich. Welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mr. Eastwood, as always, with our fantastic audience worldwide through American Freedom Radio out of Texas, but you're broadcasting out of New Zealand, and I, of course, am in the Republic of San Francisco, which is part of the United States strictly by geography. So we've got a truly international call going here, and glad that we've got this hour in which to make it happen. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Now, today we wanted to discuss Desert Storm, which you actually participated in. It's an anniversary of some description, isn't it?
That's quite right. There's been a lot of anniversaries associated with that operation 22 years ago that I've been talking about lately on my own program, which, of course, is Critical Omissions on Tuesdays and Saturday Night Firing Lines on Saturday nights. And those are both 10 to midnight Eastern Standard Time, and people can access the audio archives on YouTube, and they can get some more details. We can only cover so much in an hour, but people who want to access the audio archives, just look up Douglas Dietrich on YouTube and the Critical Omissions or Saturday Night Firing Lines. Otherwise, you can listen to me live through freedomslips.com, www.freedomslips.com, as in from freedom's lips to your ears, and we take it from there.
Okay, now, Desert Storm, as far as I am aware, was just a complete hoax fabrication in terms of the reason why they were invaded. So the allegation was that Iraq had invaded Kuwait, which technically they did. But what is not revealed to people is that the United States actually encouraged them to do it. And in fact, Iraq even asked, you know, would you retaliate if we invaded Kuwait? And they're like, nah, go ahead, bro.
Yeah. No, it was very much along that level of understanding. To put this into perspective for you, one of the things, this is going to sound very strange, but it's all connected because we live in a strange world and it's a very connected world. But it goes back, for my experience, I was personally in Baghdad in 1988, the summer of 88, which was, of course, the last year of the Gulf War I, which was al-Iraq versus Iran. And at that period of time, al-Iraq had been in its eighth year of warfare with the Iranians. Their army was one of the largest in the world for that reason. This was the Middle East's version of World War I. Both sides had lost over 1 million men in the field. And the war was grinding down to a stalemate, which was at that point intolerable. Something had to give. And I, in San Francisco, was in the middle of my vocational institutional vocational version of high school. This was not a classical high school, but a vocational institute where people were learning a trade so that they could be employed as soon as they graduated. Now, San Francisco at that point in history was the pornography capital of the world. It was a totally different world back then. We did not have computer graphics in any way, shape, or form that people understand today. What we had were comics that people actually drew. So I was a major in commercial illustration, and my income was coming through the illustration of pornographic comics. Now, I myself was under 18 years of age, but I was illustrating for adult fantasies. The I was known to be doing this at the Presidio Military Base. My high school teacher, of course, Gary Willard Hambright, was later on convicted when I turned him in for keeping his child pornography on site, the San Francisco Unified School District property, because he had no home. He was a Southern Baptist minister without a pulpit, so he lived in a church and couldn't keep his stash there. He kept it on site, the school, as art references. And so all of that was going on, and the editor of the Star Presidian, the military base newspaper where he worked, taking care of the child daycare center, and where I worked as a librarian's aide, we all knew each other, and the editor of the Star Presidian said, "Hey, Douglas, the Iraqis are looking for propagandists to draw propaganda posters about Iranian atrocities against their prisoners of war. So we have a lot of consulates here," and that's because the United Nations had been established at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco in 1942, 3 weeks, 3 days after Pearl Harbor on January 1st. So he said, "Why don't you go to one of the Iraqi consulates? They're sweating in oil money, and they'd be happy to pay for your flight over there and get you set up." And I said, "That's a great idea. It would be great for the job resume." So I went to the Iraqi consulate, and before I knew it, I was in Baghdad. Now, I happened to be in Baghdad on the same day that the USS Samuel Roberts was escorting oil tankers through the Persian Gulf and hit an Iranian ocean-going mine, and basically was severely damaged, if not sunk. And the Americans responded by shelling two Iranian oil platforms that were being used for fire control. And the Iranians were incensed. They sent out a fleet to retaliate, and the largest naval battle in modern history, which you've never heard of, took place. This was called Operation Praying Mantis. At the end of that battle, the Americans sank no less than two or three full-fledged Iranian naval warships and about six to nine suicide speedboats. So this took place, and the Iranians responded with the first use of a civilian airliner as a weapon of war. The Iranians responded by launching a Iran Air Flight 655. And Iran Air Flight 655 was launched out of a airport that was used for both civilian and military purposes, which was why they were able to get away with it. And it came out of that airport straight towards the USS Vincennes. And the USS Vincennes at that point in time was a very expensive missile cruiser, kept firing communiques electronically towards this incoming plane that was coming at it at waterline level, right above the waves, straight towards its superstructure. And if it had hit the hull of the ship and the plane would both have disintegrated. And so it was obviously in a kamikaze dive. And the captain had no choice but, after multiple communiques, to shoot it down. And when he shot it down, everyone in the Persian Gulf in area, all of Bahrain, Kuwait, the Qatar, the various Persian Gulf crucial sheikdoms or emirates, everybody was able to see on camera all of these hundreds of naked male bodies floating in the water with their hands tied behind their backs. And we all knew that civilian jetliner had been filled with Iraqi prisoners of war. So it was a situation where I called back home to the States. It was the 4th of July weekend of 1988. And I called my girlfriend at the time. I called my family. I called my coworkers. I said, did you see that footage? And everybody said, yes. And if you ask many people now, some people who have good memories will recall it when you describe that scene to them. That showed in the United States for literally 24 hours and was never seen again. And after that, the United States said, oh, Iran Air Flight 655 was filled with women and children on a pilgrimage to Al-Makka. And we shot it down, and we are going to remunerate the Iranians millions and millions of dollars for what we did. Absolutely bizarre. No one could understand the politics behind this without looking at the Iran-Contra scandal. And the Iran-Contra scandal at the time was such that the Americans had made a deal with the devil concerning the Mullahkrats, or the Shiite theocrats, the medievalists who ran Iran. And they made a deal with them, and at that point in time, they had essentially decided that they were going to switch sides against Iraq, which had been defending Israel, had been defending the West against Iran for 8 years.
Now, when you say Mullahkrats, are those who rule by the use of mullah?
I like that. That's good. The mullahs are the Iranian theocrats, the Shiite medievalist imams who rule by religious doctrine. And so they had essentially run Iran to the ground. The difference between them was that they were, of course, religious fundamentalists who viewed the Soviet Union, the United States, and Israel as all part of the same axis of evil. Now, there goes an interesting axis of evil for you, or a different perception of one. And what happened was the Iraq's form of government was Arab socialism. It was a Ba'athist fascist party that had taken on the collectivization of Stalinism. So their version of fascism was heavily influenced by communist socialism. They were very secular, and the Americans found them quite threatening. One of the things the Americans found most threatening was that when the mullahs took over Iran and the Shah fell and had to go into exile, all of these women who lived under the Shah's secular regime, which was considered an Aryan regime, by the way, the Shah's wife was German, and the Shah declared himself the king of all Aryans. The name Iran is simply the Greek word for Aryan. So we're dealing with a very complicated set of politics most people in the West aren't even aware of. But because the Shah was very fascistic in his classical sense, he allowed a lot of progress for women in the sense of getting them educated, in the sense of industrialization, in the sense of modernization. And so you had all kinds of women in professions that was an exception in all the Muslim world. And the result was when the mullahs took over, they told all of these female MDs and CEOs and CPAs and professors that if they continued to practice, they would be executed. And so all of these women had to flee Iran. They crossed the border, many of them, and they went to exile in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein was able to supply them with tanks, helicopters, whatever they wanted. And through that, all of these Amazons and headscarves formed what was known as the Mujahideen Yelhalka. And Mujahideen simply means freedom fighter in the Farsi language. And the language of Farsi extends all the way through Afghanistan into Tajikistan.
Yeah. I thought it meant holy warriors.
Yes. In Arabic, the term holy warrior would be Ghazi. But in Farsi, Mujahideen means like freedom fighter, but it usually has a religious connotation. In terms of holy warriors, you're thinking more like the Taliban. Taliban translates or literally or transliterates into the term seminarian like a Bible student, only in this case a student of the Quran. The question, of course, would be, gee, the Taliban, these seminarians, where do all these Bible students, these students of the Quran, get all these laser-guided rockets and these Abrams M1 battle tanks and these Hind helicopters? Gee, that's a, you know, how is it that these seminarians get all that? You know, that's an incredible situation. That's because the Taliban was a foreign invasion of Afghanistan. People don't realize that there's no such thing as an Afghan Taliban. All of the Taliban were Pakistani. That the Taliban was a Pakistani ISI. That's the Pakistani version of the CIA. That was a Pakistani ISI all-out invasion of Afghanistan. And the native Afghans underneath what became known as the Northern Front, which was led by a man
Hold on, Douglas.
Sure.
We're coming to break now. See, I always thought Taliban was a prohibition on television. We'll be right back after.
They prohibited badminton, by the way. Yeah, they wouldn't let anyone play badminton.
Wow, I didn't like the shuttlecock then. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. By the way, you may have heard the ads on American Freedom Radio that I made with a collection of listeners about how we need your support in order to keep the network going, for one, and secondly, to expand it. It's in desperate need of new equipment, and the easiest way to do that is to either go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the new donate banner that we just had installed last night in the wee small hours of the morning. So I would encourage people, if you have the capacity to make a monthly donation, there is an option there for $100 US a month, which I thought would be a brilliant move, because that gives them something to work from that's significant in terms of contributions to just keep the bills paid, you know, because it's actually really expensive. I've only really found out last night, just to pay for all the electricity, for all the gear that they've got there, and even to run something like 11 different radio shows that they've got on this network that they're just running out of their little house there. So, you know, please go to the AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the donate banner. And my rule is, take care of yourself and family first before you think about donating to me. And I'd like to add the proviso, donate to American Freedom Radio first before you think about donating to me also. Along the same vein of ruthless promotion and monetary compensation, we also have a group of DVDs, which are in fact relevant to this topic of the Middle East and things of that nature, which Douglas is now going to plug for himself. Douglas, proceed.
Thank you, sir. That was very graceful. I couldn't have done better. With that incredibly subtle segue, we have a DVD set of basically 100 of these sets are left. We're trying to get rid of them before the Asian Lunar New Year, which Mr. Eastwood might be somewhat familiar with, being on the Oceanian side of the world. And the Asian Lunar New Year is far more celebrated by the Chinese and the Vietnamese in this day and age. The Sinitic cultures are the Sinoviet cultures than it is by the Japanese and the Koreans. Unfortunately, but the Japanese and the Koreans also hold to it. So the correct term is not Chinese New Year, but Asian Lunar New Year's. And that begins on February 10th. So before we exit the Year of the Dragon, we would like to clean our house of these 100 DVD sets. They are pertinent to topic, and they are pertinent to many topics. One of them, Roswell and the Rising Sun, we are going to analog into text format. We are in the process of doing so. So we are not going to keep that particular DVD set. However, it is very near and dear to my heart and very important because my mother died as a direct result of producing that DVD. It was a lecture that was delivered at the Sacramento, which is the capital of the state of California, MUFON, our Mutual UFO Network chapter. the young lady who you'll see in the DVD, who has since changed her name for security reasons, was Cynthia Siegel, and Cynthia Siegel used to be the producer for UFO Connection, which was a Sacramento-based television series on, of course, ufology. She was going to interview me for that television series, and they took her series off the air. Didn't just cancel an episode. They took her series off the air. And as a result, she felt it was very important to get this news out. We set up a production that is very hurried. We didn't even have time to put up a movie screen, but it's high def, so the images are still visible. And due to the security threats we got, we didn't even advertise, but it turned out to be the most attended MUFON conference that they've ever had. And they were able to even move to a different higher grade venue after that. We were essentially in a restaurant franchise conducting this. But it came out very well, and the end result was, unfortunately, I came home to find my mother dying. And this was due to a bit of high assassination technology. I brought her to the hospital immediately, and her main aorta to her heart was dissected in two places, as the MDs said. They had never seen anything like it. It was like a laser scalpel, a surgical scalpel, had been taken to cleanly dissect her veins so that she would die in the utmost agony. This wasn't a rupture caused by somebody who was just having a high blood pressure problem and worn thin arteries that rupture and burst, because she would have died within seconds. This was something that was sliced, and they said there was no bruises, there was no open cuts, there was no point of entry. They had no idea how it was done. So this was something that was unheard of to them, and she spent a month dying in absolute agony while the blood pooled into her digestive system and everywhere else in her body and her chest cavity. So that's the price that I paid for getting the truth out with Roswell and the Rising Sun. It's directly connected to the other DVD, which is Satan's Crusaders, which talks about the United States Army and its infestation by the Satanic Chaplaincy. I talk about my almost a decade's worth of liaising under orders with the Satanic Chaplain of the United States Army, Colonel Michael Aquino. And Colonel Aquino, of course, was formerly a member of the First Church of Satan. And I have photos in that DVD you will not find anywhere else. I was educated at City College of San Francisco, which is about to close, by the way. In City College of San Francisco, I majored in criminology and criminal psychology. Also took several courses in forensic photography. The instructors who taught me forensic photography were very elderly. They were just about to retire. These were the same instructors who taught Magus Anton Zandor LaVey, the Black Pope of the First Church of Satan, his trade in forensic photography, so he could become a San Francisco police photographer, and that's how he evaded the Korean War era draft. So those same men who taught him his trade taught me mine, and I was able to use that skill to take photographs of both human and animal victims of satanic sacrifice after they were killed. So those forensic photos are available in that DVD. You will not find them anywhere else. Now, the reason this is connected with our present topic is, of course, Colonel Aquino, the Satanic Chaplain of the U.S. Army, served in Vietnam in 1968, and it's connected with both Roswell and Desert Storm, because he was brought back from his service in Vietnam as a psychological warfare expert. He was able to prove the cost effectiveness of the occult while he was in theater in Vietnam, and he was recalled with the incident of Sergeant Melvin Brown beginning to talk to his family about Roswell during the moon landings of 1969. And so they brought him back and said, this is still an Army matter. There was no Air Force at the time in 1947. Roswell Army Airfield belonged to the U.S. Army, so we want you to take care of this. That's how he instigated the entire Roswell cover-up with a satanic bent to it. He literally went to the town of Roswell and told them, this one-horse S-hole is going to dry up and blow away and wither away because President Lyndon Baines Johnson, our commander-in-chief, has ordered the transfer of Roswell Air Force Base to Texas, his home state, to keep his electorate happy. And you people will be left with no income unless you make a deal with the devil, with me. And they agreed to it, and he said, every time one of you dies, I want you to tell everybody that you saw aliens on a deathbed confession. So every time one of those seniors in Roswell dies, They're surrounded by all these people who are the town elders waiting like vultures to keep the high school funded, to keep all the museums going, the alien tourism going. And these people sign this confession, and every time Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, at that time he was a lieutenant colonel, had a pegboard, he'd place one more soul consigned to hell, one more soul signed over to Satan. He was just like, it was the biggest joke in the world to him. He was creating the Lourdes and the Medjugorje of a new religion, a new UFO cult in America. Well, how it connects to Desert Storm is just like in Vietnam, we had all kinds of senior officers who had served in World War II. That's why Americans lost the Vietnam War. They were fighting the Vietnamese as if they were confronting the Germans or the Soviets on the battlefields of Europe as in mechanized warfare as opposed to fighting a guerrilla war. And in Desert Storm, all of our high officers were Vietnam veterans. Most of these men had served in Vietnam. One of them was Colonel Michael Aquino. And Colonel Michael Aquino, that was his last war. He served in Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm, just as I did. We were in different branches of service at that time. He was an officer, and he was Army. I was an enlisted man, and I was Marine Corps. So I was not in any way, shape, or form connected with him at that point. But he was about 44, 45 years of age at that time, which is exactly the age I am now. I am now about 46 years of age. So he was as old back then as I am now. And so he was still in his prime. I like to think of myself as still in my prime. I don't feel it. And so that is how all of this connects. So I do invite all of you to hit www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is spelled just like the famous actress Marlene Dietrich. And if you're too young to remember her, just put the words diet and rich together. So just go to douglasdietrich.com. And we have these on sale, too, for the price of one until Asian Lunar New Year. So get the last 100 before they're all gone.
Now, I asked you over the break, you know how one of the reasons why people went into Iraq the second time is because of WMDs rather than STDs, weapons of mass destruction. And I was just wondering, you know, were there actually any, like, I know for a fact that there was never reported that we found any, and I know that everybody reckons it was a huge lie just to get it in there, but now I'm wondering, I wonder if they actually did find some, but they just gave it to their CIA-sponsored terrorists or something like that for use on the United States later. I have no idea. I don't know. I'm just firing out random BS here, basically. I wanted to get your
That's great, and this might carry us over the break at the bottom of the hour if we have one, so I'll definitely get into that right now. I do want to close off with what I was saying about the Mujahideen El Halqa, and I will address that because it's very important and affected me very privately, very personally, as well as many men, thousands and thousands of them. And the point is, as a matter of fact, tens of thousands of men died due to WMDs in the what Americans think of as Gulf War I. But the reality was Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm were Gulf War II. Gulf War I was Iran versus Iraq for 8 years. Gulf War II is divided into Bush War I and Bush War II. So Gulf War II is subdivided into those two phases. But
I'd always thought that Tiger Woods fought in the Gulf War.
Well, what happened with the Mujahideen al-Halqa was they were a tremendous threat to that fossilized cold warrior sitting in the White House, George Bush Sr., because the Mujahideen al-Halqa was, first of all, an all-female army. They were the most educated army in the history of mankind ever to hit the field. They were all MDs, attorneys at law, CPAs, CEOs. It was an incredibly well-educated and well-trained force. They adapted easy to using high-tech weapons, tanks, and helicopters very quickly, and they scored the highest kill ratios of all of Saddam Hussein's forces against the mullahs of Iran. And they were all set to roll into Tehran and throw the mullahs into the Caspian Sea. And what happened was, at that point in time, they were identified as communists. They were very Marxian in their ideology. And, of course, Saddam Hussein was also a Stalinist. I never met the man personally, and one of the reasons why was because during that period of crisis, he had conducted a pilgrimage not to Al-Makkah or Al-Madinia, but rather to Stalin's birthplace in the Caucasus in Georgia and to his final resting place in Moscow. where he is on display. So he had statues of Stalin all over the place. His troops were trained in Soviet-style tactics and carried AK-47s, whereas the mullahs, Pazdarin, or Republican Guard of the Iranians, carried German Heckler and Koshis and machine guns, H&Ks. And so we have two very different sponsor states for both different cultures, and the end result was the Americans identified Al-Iraq as a communist satellite state of Mikhail Gorbachev's Soviet Union. So they said, we've got to wipe these people out, because if those feminists take over Iran, who is dealing with us through this Iran-Contra scandal, then we're, our entire Iran-Contra plan gets destabilized, and these women wind up setting up a communist Iran, and then you've got a kind of Stalinist state in Iraq, communist state in Iran, both of them kind of allied to the Soviet Union. The Americans said this was the ultimate domino nightmare theory. So that was the reason for Bush War One. So when Bush went in, he fought it Korean War style, where he basically considered it like a limited war. He had to do it Korean War style, where you had 22 nations underneath the United Nations umbrella. He started this multinational coalition, and we went into Al-Kuwait, and there were at that time most definitely WMDs that were sold to Saddam Hussein by the United States. And at that time he had taken all of these chemical fertilizers, converted them into cyclosarine nerve gas, which he had deployed against the Kurds and killed thousands and thousands of Kurdistani minority peoples. And their major storage facility was in Kamisaya. And at Kamisaya, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made one of the few penetrative invasions into Al-Iraq in Operation Desert Storm. And they blew that facility. And at that point, the Marine Corps had already plowed all the way through Al-Kuwait. We went straight through the minefields, and all of the frontline Marines were exposed to genocidal-level nerve agents. So I and all these other Marines, you can see these photos. They're rather famous, or were at the time, that were published in Newsweek magazine. You see all of these jarheads wearing mop gear, mind you, chemical warfare gear, but their hoods are all off, and they're looking at these technicolor mushroom clouds in the distance. That's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers blowing the facilities at Kamisaya, and all of us idiots with our hoods off are sucking it into our lungs like human vacuum cleaners. And the whole reason for that was the mop gear is charcoal-lined rubber. It's 110 degrees on the desert on a cool day, and we were losing as many pounds of water weight in as many minutes with our hoods and our mop gear on. So we had a choice of just dying of dehydration or sucking in the nerve gas and dying later. Most of us chose to die later. We all did, as a matter of fact. We had been dropping.
Well, hold on, Douglas. We're coming to break now. The feminist T-shirt that says the only Bush that I trust is my own comes to mind. We'll be right back.
People, wherever you roam.
Welcome back.
And admit that the waters around you have grown.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's our final segment with the illustrious, indomitable, and inimitable Douglas Dietrich. And we were talking over the break about how Sarah has had a bit of an ear infection. You know, when you wear earmuffs, ladies and gentlemen, and it kind of creates a breeding ground for bacteria inside your head. So she's been laid up on the couch for the last 2-3 days and can't go to work because of a infection that occurred because she was going to work. That's a real pain in the ass. I'd really love to be able to kind of have enough income so that I could support both of us so that she wouldn't actually have to go to work and, you know, she'd help out around the house and help me with some of the work that I have to do here and that kind of thing. It's just not possible at the moment unless people start donating huge, huge quantities of money to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, which I encourage. Please go to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com and stick us out a nice wee little donation. Preferably not so wee and not so little, and or a subscription for between $1 and $5 or $10 or $20 a month. So give us something to work on day to day. All right, now my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich. We wanted to go over that weapons of mass destruction in Iraq question and whether or not there even were any, because what I heard was that during Gulf War One, or Bush Gulf War One, as you kind of is there
Bush War One,
Bush War. Sounds like some kind of conflict that would happen in outback Australia. And what happened was, as far as I've heard, is that Marines and Rangers would find these facilities that are stocked full of all of these weapons and chemical agents and things like that, and they were shocked at what they saw on all the boxes. Made in the USA, because the USA had been busy selling weapons to them for a long time, and they were like, oh my God, we can't take these weapons out of here, because then all the news cameras and everything like that would see us taking out US-made weapons out of all these Iraqi weapons facilities after we've invaded them, and completely make us look like a bunch of criminal...
like exactly lines. What they are, yeah.
It would make us look like what we are. So instead of owning up and just admitting who you are and what you do as a U.S. administration, not putting anything on the U.S. Individuals or soldiers or anything like that, they had no real part in this, they detonated the weapons bunkers. And... you know, it's like, here's the choice. Okay, we've got a choice. We can either come clean and be honest and take our licks from in terms of public relations, or we can poison every single soldier that we duped into serving us for the rest of their fracking life and create a new disease that never existed called Gulf War Syndrome.
But that was one factor of it. As a matter of fact, what had happened at Camp Messiah, that was the biggest blow of the facilities where most of these weapons of mass destruction were gathered. That was the core of it, and let's call it the central star of the constellation of whatever other storage sites they may have found throughout Yalirak. It was in the southerly region. It was very close to the Kuwaiti border. And that's why all of us who had gone through Kuwait were able to see it and literally see the results of the explosion. And so the reason that they blew those bunkers was exactly the reason you stated, to hide the trail of receipts, which went back to companies such as Halliburton and major chemical industries in the United States. So we paid the price. Now, they were claiming, this is, people might ask who are war geeks or claim they were in the military, or were in the military and didn't see crap. People might ask, why didn't we just inject ourselves with atropine? Okay, well, you inject yourself with atropine when you know you've been sucking in chemical weapons. What people don't realize is that the United States military ordered us not to inject atropine because they were telling us we were not inhaling chemical weapons. They were saying all that funny smell that you're inhaling, and you don't really smell too much of anything with cyclosarine nerve gas coming at that distance. Basically, they were just telling us we were free from exposure. By the way, we had all kinds of equipment that was supposed to sense this. We also had dogs. There were 500,000 men in Operation Desert Shield. There were 41,000 women. And there were 35,000 dogs that had been brought in country. And the dogs were rendered useless by a totally different phenomena that hopefully we might have a few moments to get into. But as for the weapons themselves, they ultimately didn't work. It was on June 21st of 1996, which was years later, that the Pentagon had made an announcement that shattered what little credibility they had on medical engineers on medical and engineering subjects. They had for half a decade been insisting that no one serving in the Gulf War had been exposed to chemical or biological weapons. They were forced to recant, and tens of thousands of Allied soldiers, they admitted, were exposed to nerve gas after the Iraqi ammunition depot containing chemical weapons was blown at Camp Messiah. And the detectors picked up no sign of chemical release that day, but it turned out the detection equipment appeared to have been faulty. By the way, I believe that this was an entire lie, that the detection equipment worked, whereas the dogs didn't, but they simply did not admit to it. Either that or it was intentionally sabotaged by operatives so that they wouldn't have to admit to it. And the reason why was they didn't want anyone to know about the trail of receipts of which you speak. So we all paid the price for that. And over the years, very few people died in the Gulf War. The amount of fatalities in Operation Desert Storm was something like 300 to 500, which is incredibly small for a military operation, except for a scattered few Marines during an Iraqi spoiler attack at Al-Kafia, and except for about 8 or 9 soldiers killed by a stray Scud missile. Every single one of those men was killed by friendly fire. Every single one of those men was killed by another American. But the rest, tens of thousands have died after Operation Desert Storm because of exposure to cyclosarine nerve gas, which I was exposed to, or to depleted uranium. And the point was that I was lucky enough where I was dishonorably discharged, which is a whole other story in and of itself, which we could speak of in the near future. But the point was, because of that, I had no access to the VA. And as a result, I had to pay for private doctors at UCSF, which were willing to do experimental surgery, which ultimately went into my lungs, scraped clear all the blisters caused by the chemical weapons, and stapled my lungs to my rib cage. Until that point in time, my lungs had collapsed 7 times, and I was set to either be intubated the rest of my life with chest tubes coming out, walking around with a machine, or I could die. So I underwent experimental surgery. Didn't pay for it because it cost too much, and that's why I have no credit. But as opposed to that, the other Marines who suffered what they called DRI, D-R-I, disabling respiratory illnesses, got access to the VA, and they're all dead. So I'm at 30% lung capacity, but I'm way ahead of the game in that regard. So the reason for the dogs not working is because of what a phenomena that no one was acknowledging in country. We had a phenomena which the Arabic popular culture acknowledged, known as the Desert Ghouls. And what had happened was we spent 9 months setting up for Operation Desert Storm in what was known as Operation Desert Shield. And it was in the first few days of Operation Desert Shield on August 7th of 1990 that King Fahd agreed to accept Allied troops in the House of Saud. This was within days of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Al.
Wasn't this after, I think, some kind of U.S. official came to the House of Saud and said, hey, look, there's Iraqi military massing at your borders. You know, I've seen the satellite images and everything. And the House of Saud goes, really? Could you show us the satellite images? And they goes, no, you're going to have to trust us and allow us to put massive new United States bases in your territory instead.
Well, the House of Saud is just it's a horror story in and of itself, and they're a horrible group of people in the royal dynasty. At that time in history, the Womanis, or the Gulf Kingdom, or Emirate of Woman, was all of their domestic servants. And what happened was when the king of Oman went into the House of Saud, they all treated him like he was dirt. They left him in rooms alone with babies that were wailing, that needed their diapers changed, and were saying, oh, hey, why didn't you change the diapers? Or everywhere he went, people would shove brooms and dustbins in his face and say, hey, don't forget to clean up before you leave. And he went back to Oman and he said to all of his domestic workers that were still in the House of Saud, all of you come home within 3 months or you lose your Womani citizenship. And if they lost their citizenship, that would render them nationless, and in the House of Saud, that legally would render them slaves under other Quranic law, under Sharia. So they all left, went back home to Oman, and that's how all of these Filipinos and Filipinas began working in the House of Saud as their domestic servants. That all happened during that period of Operation Desert Shield that we were there. But at the time, the only honorable professions, as far as I'm concerned, were like police and military forces. None of them otherwise work. Basically, a foreign population does all the work in the House of Saud otherwise. And during that period of time of Desert Shield, after Kuwait was invaded, King Fahd agreed to have troops in there. That was on the same day I was dishonored. What happened was there was a girls' dormitory on fire. We were on leave. We had no weapons. And the Mutawwa'een, Saudi religious police, were nearby. And by the way, is this the end of the whole show? Or?
It is. We've only got about maybe 30 seconds left to go. But I'd like to leave with something from Bill Hicks. He said, oh, Iraq, they've got incredible weapons, incredible weapons. Hell yeah, I know that. We looked at the receipt. But as soon as that check clears, we're going in. What time's the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9. For God and country, and he's a Hitler, and a fetus. Yeah, here you go. Whatever you need. Let's go. Whatever you, the apathetic American docile masses, need to get behind. Here, here's a fetus. Look at it.
Oh, it's a little fetus. Oh, he's a bad man. He's a hit. I hate this man all of a shit.
Douglas Dietrich from DouglasDietrich.com. Thank you very much for incredible, info, really, which basically nobody else really has access to. I wish we could say more, but unfortunately, here's the break. Back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, the seventh state of Australia. My very special guest from one of the other states of Australia is Christopher Field, otherwise kind of known as Topher, like a gopher. I don't know why they call you that, or is it what you call yourself? Welcome to the show anyway.
Well, thank you. It's Topher is actually the second half of Christopher, so it makes as much sense as calling someone Chris. If you're going to shorten someone's name, there's no particular reason to pick the first half over the second. T-O-P-H-E-R.
All right. Okay.
It does kind of make sense in my own little twisted world.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you, but I think we live in a topsy-turvy world, and in order to put it the other way around, you got to do things the opposite way.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that works.
All right. Well, there's a manufactured justification to make ourselves feel better about it anyway. Now, would you be able to explain just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do? And I now know that you've been given a show on American Freedom Radio as well.
Mm. Yes, indeed. And, well, for those who haven't sort of come across my show or anything, don't know anything about me, I was born in Australia, lived in Australia all my life, and in Melbourne, actually, for the last 28 years. Frightening myself with how fast time is flying. And so, yes, I'm very much a native of one of the, what I'll say, the original states of Australia before we started adopting our neighbours to the southeast, that being, of course, you over there in New Zealand. And, my first real encounter with the idea that perhaps life and the world wasn't working the way that it should was around about 5-6 years ago. When I began to, we were suffering a very, very severe drought here in the southeast of Australia, and water storages were getting low, and things were actually looking pretty grim for a while there. And I began to look at what our government was doing in response to this drought, and in order to try and provide water for all of us. And I began to realize that they were ignoring all of the best options for purely ideological anti-dam sort of reasons, and they were building a massive desalination plant at huge expense, ridiculous expense, absolutely absurd, and with no justification environmentally, no justification in terms of the water supply itself, no justification economically. If every which way you looked at it, it was worse than some of the other options that they were ignoring. And that kind of was the catalyst for me. And it's funny how we all tend to go through our lives without really questioning much until we see something that we feel like it touches us personally. And that tends to be what wakes people up. Something, the government in some way reaches out and touches you, and all of a sudden you feel a personal stake in what's going on. And it's funny how the water issue did that for me. And what it was realizing that I was, other people and kids in my church and young people that I knew on my street and so forth had never actually had a water fight. As simple and as silly as that sounds, but kids who were born at the very start of the drought that we had here in southeastern Australia had lived their entire life under such strict water restrictions that they were never going to turn a hose on each other. They were never going to fill up water bombs and throw them at each other. They were never going to turn a sprinkler on in the front lawn and run around and jump over it the way that I had done in my own childhood. And such a silly, small little thing, which really, talk about first world problems. This is not, nobody is dying from a lack of water fights. But that was enough just to begin the process some 5-6 years ago, and things have certainly come a long way in my own mind since then.
I imagine Super Soaker sales weren't terribly high around that point.
yeah, not doing great.
Poor dears.
Terrible.
Yeah. Now, how exactly did you start to get activated as well? What did you start doing? Did you get into film or radio straight away? Or
well, that was an interesting one. It's funny how things in life can work out. A friend of mine knew that I was I had a background in film and television. That's thanks to my dad. My dad was involved in Channel 31, which is a community television station here in Melbourne. Very low budget. Very much a case of just giving people access to broadcast. And of course, it was set up before YouTube and these various other options were available. So I grew up doing some editing and some camera work and that sort of thing. And a friend of mine knew that I was looking to get back into that sort of thing. I got out of it once I sort of became an adult. And he heard of an opportunity where a producer here in Australia was starting something at the time called Project Next and was looking for television presenters and news presenters and producers and so forth to staff this show. And as part of the application for a job, you had to put in a video, something that you'd done. So I decided to do a video on the water situation, the thing that was really bugging me at the time, and the fact that we were building a desalination plant when that was definitely not the best of the available options. So I headed out on my own with my own video camera and made that. Literally, I'd set up the camera, lock it off on the tripod, flip the screen around so I could see it from out in front. I'd walk around in front of the camera and look at myself on that little screen and say my script. And I travelled all over Victoria. I wanted to sort of be on location with each of the things that I was talking about when I talked about dams or water supplies or various other things. And so I then submitted that as my application for a job, essentially, and didn't get the job. Surprise, surprise. What did surprise me was that once I put it up on YouTube, it started to get watched by people. And I began to get phone calls and emails and people agreeing with me and a lot of people saying, oh, finally, someone has got the guts to say what we all know is true, but no one's willing to say. And so that, for me, was sort of the beginning of the process, I guess. I got drawn in after that as more and more people began to say to me, hey, can you cover another subject? Can you talk about this? Can you research that? And that was the beginning of the process that drew me in ultimately to where now I have a YouTube channel with over a dozen sort of videos, mostly dealing with the water issue. That's where I stayed for a number of years. I just continued to deal with the water crisis here in Victoria, and then moving on as I have now into other areas of government and the size of government and broader liberty issues. So I have a YouTube channel, and I also have as you mentioned before, a radio station of my own at 9 p.m. on Thursdays Central U.S. time for 2 hours every week.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had Leon Pittard from Fair Dinkum Radio on the show yesterday, and what he's told me is that Australia is now advancing some kind of really scary sounding draconian free speech censoring kind of legislation. And it's scared the Fosters out of me.
Look, this has been brewing for a while, and you've got to.
Interesting choice of words.
Yes, exactly. You've got to keep in mind with Australia that we are literally at the moment being governed by a former communist who many believe is still a communist, but that she simply changed her stripes in order to be more acceptable. Julia Gillard, don't quote me on the exact details, but I believe she was the editor of the Socialist Forum's weekly or monthly publication for quite some time and was a member for many years of her life. And she dismisses that as almost like a childhood type phase that she went through. But the reality is she was a member for many years, was heavily involved and was responsible for publishing a number of different publications on their behalf. And one of the things that she said while she was the editor there was that it may be necessary for socialists like herself to join other more mainstream political parties and then sway them in their direction, because she felt it would be too difficult under the banner of socialism to achieve what they wanted to achieve. Well, surprise, surprise, here she is now, some decades later, the leader of the Labor Party here in Australia, having, in the minds of some people, myself included, I believe that she's simply carrying out the strategy that she put into words all those decades ago. She has now moved into a more mainstream party and is now pulling that mainstream party in the direction of her true ideology, which is genuine socialism, I would say borderline red state communism. She says that she's had a change, that she joined the Labor Party because she grew up and she matured and you know, here she is representing mainstream Australian values. I think the agenda that she's pushing tells us very clearly which one of those two options is true. And it's fairly clear to me that she has not abandoned her true ideology that she held all those years ago. So that's one of the things you need to keep in mind. When we're talking about Australia at the moment, we are led by people who think it would be a wonderful thing to introduce full-on statist communism. Now, they can't come out and publicly say that, but they are pursuing that agenda. So when do you remember the news of the world hacking scandal over in England a little while ago?
The phone hacking scandal.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Now, what that was a subcontractor acting for a subsidiary of an Australian-owned media empire. So think about the links there. A subcontractor acting for a subsidiary did something illegal and immoral. That was the grounds for a sweeping inquiry into the Australian media. Why would you investigate the Australian media when it was a subcontractor of a subsidiary that had done something wrong on the other side of the planet? Well, simply because
maybe if they wanted to use it as an excuse to get rid of journalists and other commentators that were saying things they didn't like.
That's exactly it. They were revealing a pre-existing ideology. They'd wanted to do this for a long time, and finally they felt like they had their chance. Now, that was called the Finkelstein Report, the report that came out of that inquiry, and I dedicated one of my videos to that, and you can find that on a website. If I can just plug my website for a moment, you can find that on a website called forbiddenhistory.com. Forbiddenhistory.com. It's a double D, forbiddenhistory.com. And you'll find there's one out of three videos are up. There's slots for three videos. One of them is there. It's called The Forbidden History of Unpopular People. And it talks all about the fact that ideological advancement over the centuries has often come from people standing alone, speaking their mind, being very unpopular, often persecuted. And in that video, I segue then into the Finkelstein Report and have a look at the recommendations and essentially pull it apart, in my view, of course, because I made the video. So, of course, I think I did a good job. But you're welcome and you're free to have a look at that and decide for yourself. That's had, I think, 60 or 70,000 views now across mostly throughout Australia. And, so that's the first in a trilogy. I'm currently working on the second one. We're getting fairly close to releasing that one. And then the third one will be a fairly quick process. I'm already well into the pre-production of the third one now, but that's another story. So, yes, we are looking at some pretty draconian free speech laws here in Australia. They failed with the Finkelstein report. There was enough of a pushback that they've just dropped that one, and that's persona non grata. Now they don't talk about the Finkelstein report. They've moved on. But they are going to continuously change tactics and continuously look for a way in, so to speak.
What I found is they push the envelope, and if it gets pushed back, they just wait a while, and then they push it again.
They push again, exactly. And so I'm of the view that whenever they push something, we need to start, instead of just stopping them from achieving what they want to achieve, we need to start pushing back and forcing them to lose ground in those areas. And that's what I think is in the process of happening in the US at the moment on gun rights and a few other issues, where the pushback is actually going to outweigh the action on the part of the government. And that's what we need to do over here when it comes to free speech. We need to push back so hard that existing anti-speech legislation, which has gone unquestioned for the last 5 or 10 years, begins to fall apart. And no longer be enforced and begins to be repealed as a result of such a strong pushback because of them trying to take more of our free speech.
Mm. And there's an interesting thing when we're talking about pushing back. John Key, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, he just had a picture taken and he was holding a T-shirt up in front of him that says, if this gets 1 million Facebook likes, I will resign as Prime Minister.
You sure that's not a Photoshop job?
I was like.
Dear, if only all politicians would agree to something that simple, hey?
Yeah.
The world would be a better place.
You see quite constantly this Fabian socialist type of mentality. David Icke calls it the totalitarian tiptoe. But what's interesting is that it spreads across both the false right parties and the false left parties. So
absolutely.
In Australia, you've got Gillard enforcing similar draconian policy and things of that nature that we're doing in New Zealand under an alleged right-wing policy by John Key, who said in an open conference that what we're doing is taking a moderate approach and taking small steps in a lot of different sectors, which eventually adds up to a lot. And that's just like, that's Fabian socialism right there. Absolutely. You take little steps and eventually
you get
hammer blow.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're seeing. And unfortunately, even take, for example, a man that many people hold up as a great example of a conservative prime minister here in Australia, John Howard, was responsible for introducing so-called anti-terror laws that have stripped away a great deal of the natural-born human rights that we have, the presumption of innocence until being proven guilty, the fact that they have to actually lay a charge against you if they're going to detain you and so forth. Now, what we've seen over here is nowhere near as sinister as the NDAA in the US, which has been recently passed by Barack Obama. But nonetheless, that was a wake-up call for me. I used to be in the Australian military, and when I was in the Army Reserves over here, I was actually a supporter of the war in Iraq. And while I was in recruit course itself, the only media we were allowed to see was a half an hour of news every day. And that was at a time when North Korea were doing some of their launching test launching of nukes or potential nuclear missile, carriers and so forth. And there was a real sense that we might be about to go into North Korea. And I'll be honest with you, I was excited by the prospect. I was looking forward to going to war against a tyrant, against this bad, evil country. Now, I still regard North Korea as a tyrant. I still regard them as a bad, evil country. What's changed in my opinion is that I don't regard us or anyone else as the world's police force, that I don't believe that we should be spending our treasure and our blood going into other countries to sort them out, to try and give them democracy from the top down. It doesn't work. Democracy and representative government is something that must be demanded from beneath. It must be the people who stand up and say, no, we want to be represented in our government. If you go into a totalitarian society, replace their totalitarian government with some form of voting system, all they are going to do is vote for a totalitarian government. That's all they know. And unless they have a drive within themselves, a desire for democracy or desire for freedom and representative government, small government themselves, they will fall straight back into the trap that we think we're trying to dig them out of. And we're sacrificing lives and money to put these people on a treadmill that will ultimately not get them what we think it will.
To use a sports analogy, if you want a level playing field, it must come from the grassroots.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it has to. It's like saying, I'm the boss of this house and I have my wife's permission to say so. Clearly, if you need your wife's permission, you're not the boss of the house. And it's turning around and asking your government for your freedom is actually, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're saying that the government has the right to deny it from you in the first place. You're actually putting them above you in the very act of asking them for permission to be free. You're either free or you're not. And going into countries where they don't have that mindset and sacrificing the lives of good men is just, it's counterproductive.
All right. Christopher Field, we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the semi-operatic Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And I would also like to remind people that the donate banner to AmericanFreedomRadio.com is now on the homepage, and I would encourage people to support the network. In fact, we had a big meeting last night for how to do a big fundraiser for AFR to get them some new equipment that they need. And me, personally, I'm in need of a new computer. This one just can't take the heat. And I mean, literally can't take the heat. It was overheating yesterday, and you know when computers are overheating, Topher, they just take 10 times as long to do just a, such a simple thing, and doing the archives and video processing every day, it's just getting too much for this poor machine, and it's going to cost like, I don't know, $4,000 for another one, and there's no fracking way I can afford that. So hopefully there might be some incredibly generous, lovely person out there who'd be willing to, you know, bail my ass out again, because let me share something with you, ladies and gentlemen. Not a single one of the things that I am wearing currently on my body, sitting on, or doing my work with, I've bought myself. I'm not kidding. Every camera that I have, every set of lights that I have, every chair that I have, every computer that I have, has been given to me by somebody like you. And I just keep working in order to earn more and more equipment so I can just keep working. It's a perpetual cycle, like the Irish, getting drunk, feeling guilty about it, and then getting up in the morning and getting drunk again to deal with it. All right, my very special guest, Topher Field, welcome back.
I'm just trying to compose myself. I'm not sure that analogy was quite the one you were looking for, but hey, it works. I can relate to your computer overheating problem. I spent years editing my own videos on a fairly old piece of hardware. I put computers together. I buy the parts and put them together myself. And my last build for myself was about 5 years ago. And up until early last year, that was the computer I was still using, trying to edit in HD and all that sort of thing. So I feel your pain, brother. And I trust that that someone gets behind you and gets you what you need. I'm now on a laptop, actually, that's doing the job quite nicely. But no, I feel your pain.
Mm-hmm. And also, I wanted to reiterate as well that this is basically this. We're all in the same boat in this movement. Yeah, I mean, if you can show me somebody who actually makes a decent living off of telling the truth without working harder than they should ever have to, point them out to me, please.
There's a handful. There's only a handful. It's a bit like elite sports. There's a handful of people making you know quite good money out of what they're doing, and the rest of us are just peddling like mad, trying to keep up with ourselves, really.
Mm-hmm. And even those people who are at the top levels actually earning a decent living, they had to bust their humps hugely in order to get where they are. Like, I had George Norrie on the show, Topher, and he told me that when he was, I think when Art Bell was kind of getting a bit sick and stuff like that, and he asked George to host in his absence on Coast to Coast, he was doing 4 hours local radio in St. Louis, and then traveling across town to the Clear Channel or whatever it is, to then do 4 hours on Coast to Coast right through the night. Goodness. So doing 8 hours of radio per day.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you. I don't tend to have a lot of guests in my 2 hour show, and it usually takes me about 8 hours to prepare 2 hours worth of radio. So I can imagine trying to be on air for 8 hours is a pretty demanding schedule.
I mean, even in those positions, you know, you have assistants and things of that nature, but people like you or I mean, we're the one-man band. We're like, I don't know, who was that dude in Mary Poppins who literally had like a whole bunch of instruments and stuff like
that?
Dick Van Dyke or something.
Yes. Often copied. You see attempts to copy him in amongst buskers from time to time, but you're right. The quintessential one-man band.
And as we were talking about over the break, never underestimate the power of a small, determined minority. And if you think one person can't make a difference, and this happened to you last night, lock yourself in a room with a mosquito and see how that mentality works out for you.
Yeah, and if a mosquito in the room isn't annoying enough, try being sound asleep and having the thing land on the inside of your outer ear canal. and see how quickly you manage to jump up and find a light switch to find out what in the world is going on in the room. It kept me awake for around about half an hour before I finally killed that one because it was loud. It had some sort of a cloaking device making it invisible. I could not see no matter how hard I tried. And it had some kind of amplifying device making it impossible to sleep whilst it was in the room. These mosquitoes are getting technologically very advanced. I don't know what gear this thing was carrying, but it was something out of Star Trek. I could not see it no matter how hard I tried. Well, I finally killed it after half an hour, put my head back down on the pillow, and I could hear another one in the room. It had brought a cousin along for the ride, so I ended up just wrapping the pillow around my head so that I couldn't hear it and putting up with the fact that I was going to wake up with mosquito bites. But that is essentially what you and I are to the establishment. Very, very annoying mosquitoes. On the one hand, we should be easily swatted and swept aside, but on the other hand, if there's enough of us, and if we're independent enough, and that's the key, I think, the truth movement as we see it today, it's not a centralized bureaucracy. You can't take one person out. I mean, look at what happened when Andrew Breitbart tragically passed away. If anything, his passing has actually spurred on a lot more people to step up into the void that he left behind. If anything, whilst no one has actually managed to fill his shoes, those were amazing shoes to fill, the sheer number of people who are now stepping up and taking responsibility for speaking out and trying to get the truth out there, I think probably outweighs his individual effort. And that's what we hope to achieve in this movement, is not to create an alternative establishment, but to turn around and say, no, each of us actually has the power and the responsibility to do what we can. It's not about a centralized system. It's not about replacing one status system with another. It's about actually re-empowering the individual to, if I can steal an American term here, to enjoy the pursuit of their own happiness.
Mm. This is why
they see fit.
This is why I like the mentality and the way American Freedom Radio is done, because it's like a family, and nobody's really even told what to do. You know, they're given advice or anything like that. But you have to be really, really, you have to do something pretty bad in order to get on the wrong side of AFR, I've found. It's just, I've got this aversion to joining groups, to joining teams and things like that have a top down, you must do this and do it in this way, and that's why I like this network, is because of the freedom that they give me, and essentially I've never even had so much as a curtailing or a criticism of my show from the network in nearly 3 years of being on here, because it's that free.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, I understand the value of corporate structure and so forth, and it's necessary in business and what have you. But when it comes to being a network that prides itself on speaking the truth, really, I have to agree with you. I think these guys have got it right. And, you know, I've listened to a number of other presenters, and I myself don't agree with a number of things that get said. And I'm sure that must be true of the people behind American Freedom Radio itself. But they choose to value freedom above their own particular view of any given subject. And I think that's incredibly valuable and more power to them.
And also, we've been talking, I talked about yesterday on the show about sort of infighting and how it really just plays into the hands of the New World Order, hook, line, and sinker, doesn't it?
Well, the interesting thing is, it's so easy to allow the small differences to divide rather than the broad brushstroke similarities to unite. There's a film that I'm absolutely in love with. Christian Bale played the lead, called Equilibrium, and it's essentially a post-apocalyptic film. And that I kid you not, is probably the film I've seen more than any other film in my life. There's something about that film, and in particular, something about Christian Bale's performance in that film that I love, and I could watch as many times as there are hours in the day. But there's a particular line in there. And they've got this brainwashing thing going on, and this father figure, who is essentially the head of this totalitarian society, is often up on billboards, and we can hear him speaking and see his face just as people are walking around going about their daily business. And one of the things that he said is that it's an incontrovertible fact that mankind has united with infinitely more purpose in pursuit of war than they ever have in pursuit of peace. And it's interesting. I mean, that's true. As much as that's an awful thing to say, I think historically when you look at it, it tends to be true. And one of the things that we need to do within the truth movement is to change that. We need to actually unite in the pursuit of our own freedom, and the freedom to disagree with each other than to band together into our own little subgroups and subcultures within the movement in order to pursue our own particular angle on one thing or another.
Mm-hmm. I do prefer prefer freewheeling collaboration. Like, you know, you're independent, you've got your own thing going on, and then we get together and we do something together, and then we both go in our own opposite directions, having endured a positive relationship and actually created something together. That's the mentality that I think is actually going to save this world.
Well, in reality, it comes back to empowering the individual. It's the same as what we were talking about before the break. When you force people into, and the key word here is force, when you force people into corporate type structures and top down hierarchies, you instantly, it has a number of interesting effects. And the analogy that I give, whenever, and this is true of a status society, it's true of a company, it's true of any kind of organization that you may wish to look at. The question of individuals taking responsibility for their own individual actions and their own individual lives is a very, very important one. I was talking to a very socialist friend of mine, and he was challenging me and saying, you know, why do you think that the individual can look after themselves better when these bureaucrats have access to more information and better information, and they can make a dispassionate decision from a distance, when, you know, if the individual's making a decision for themselves, everyone's just going to do whatever's best for them? And I said, well, think about it like this. Imagine, and this actually happened to me, this analogy comes from an actual real-world experience. Imagine that you're sitting in the food court of a massive shopping centre, and it was Melbourne Central here in the middle of Melbourne City where I was sitting, and the fire alarm goes off. All of a sudden you're hearing, whoop, 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 evacuate now. That whole kind of, you know, radio voice that comes over and tells you all to leave the building, and the alarms were going off and so forth. I was sitting there eating, or whatever it was that I was eating, and I looked up, and I looked around the room, and you know what I saw? A whole bunch of other people looking back at me. That's all I saw. No one got up out of their chairs and actually left the building. The fire alarm, for all useful purposes, was completely ignored. The only way we were leaving the building was if someone had come running through saying, oh, there's a fire over there, over there, over there. Or maybe if someone in a uniform had physically walked through the area and gone, okay, everyone, sorry, guys, we need you all to leave. Then maybe we would have stood up and started to leave. But the building was so big, and the chance of there being a real fire was so remote, that we just sat there and went, oh, well, it's not going to affect us. We're not at risk here. It's a massive building. Someone's probably just burnt their toast at a lunchroom somewhere. We could downplay the risks. We could ignore the risks. Now, compare that response, that complete lack of responsibility, as it were. For if you're home alone, just go into bed, you've just turned out the light, put your head down, and the smoke alarm in your kitchen goes off. How quickly do you get out of bed and find out what's going on? How quickly do you get out there and take responsibility? And the simple fact is, the reason for the difference in response is because you're the one at risk. No longer is this a massive building with lots of people and I'm sure someone else will take care of it. No, this is your building. This is your life at stake. If this place burns down, you're the one who suffers. And so you respond. And this is the value of individuals. This is the value of empowering individuals. When we say to someone, you are responsible for what happens in your life. You are responsible for providing for your own medical care. You are responsible for providing for your own future. You are responsible for making sure that you get the education that you need in order to continue making career choices along the course of your life. You are responsible for raising the children that you give birth to, and so on and so forth. When we actually turn around and go, no, you the individual, you are individually responsible, then we start to see people step up. For as long as we move towards this collectivized statist mindset where we're all group responsible, where kind of if everyone's responsible, in the end, no one's responsible. No one cares about the spot fires that start. No one cares about the alarms and the warnings that are being sounded within a collectivist society, because that mindset kicks in. Someone else will take care of it. Oh, I'm sure if it was really all that serious, someone would tell me. Until one day something happens, the alarms get ignored, and things really do go horribly wrong. And I personally am of the view that we're on the cusp of that right now, that things are in the process economically and socially and in terms of government intervention in our lives are in the process right now of going horribly wrong. And we're ignoring all the alarms. We're just sitting here going, oh, I'm sure someone else will take care of that. Or most people are. You and I aren't. And I would trust that everyone who's listening to us would be on a different page. But society at large is just sitting there thinking that the people sounding the alarm are the kooks, the crazies, the paranoid people, the ones wearing tinfoil hats, all the rest of it, all those sorts of cliched responses that we get when we try and raise the alarm. And essentially, it's because that group mindset has kicked in. It's not my problem. Someone else will take care of it. They're like all of us sitting in that food court in the massive supermarket, hearing the alarm go off and going, yeah, whatever.
Well, A friend of mine once said that if you empower individuals with responsibilities, they become more responsible. If you disempower them by saying those responsibilities are actually somebody else's, they become very irresponsible.
Yeah. It's funny how in society, we all know that taxing something is a punishment. We all know that the government from time to time goes, oh, young people are drinking too much alcohol, we're going to raise taxes on Alco-Pops, or people are smoking too much, we're going to raise taxes on cigarettes, because it's going to dissuade people from buying and using those things. And then people like me turn around and go, oh, okay, you do realize that you're taxing and therefore punishing people who work hard. You know, if I choose to spend my day earning a living, you're going to punish me with a tax. And the psychological result is the same.
Right. Topher Field, we'll be right back after the break at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Would encourage people to visit that website and have a look around at all the archives and things of that nature, both for my show and his. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
And no one like me.
Welcome back. It's the final segment today of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Topher Field. What was the website again? Was it Forbidden Something?
Well, I've got a few. I need to consolidate them together. But the one that matters the most at the moment is ForbiddenHistory.com. That's the one where you'll find my documentary all about free speech here in Australia. If you keep an eye on that, sometime in the next fortnight, I'll be releasing the second in that trilogy. And then within a month or so after that, I'll be releasing the third one in that trilogy. And they deal with taxation and then the size of government, respectively.
Okay, and this is not to be mixed up with For Biden History, which is exposing the background of the current vice president of the United States.
Sure.
Which doesn't exist. I just made it up. But
I couldn't tell. You were so smooth and just it was so believable. I couldn't tell you made that up.
Yeah, I'm a pretty smooth bastard. Now, we're talking over the break about how... I preach to the converted. I know I do. I don't deny it. It's because my mentality in this movement isn't actually to wake anybody up. I don't think you can wake anybody up. Nobody forced me to watch 160 freaking documentaries or something like that inside of a 6-month period and radically change my worldview. I don't think you can wake people up. You can say things and ultimately it's their choice. But what I found is once you do wake up, my God. Learning that the entire world is a lie and everything you've been working for your entire life is just BS, that's really depressing. It's really harsh. So my objective is to keep y'all entertained and happy and not depressed, because then you might do what happened to the guy who helped me start Guerrilla Media, which is why the website looks like crap. Go back to sleep and go back to work. I don't want that to happen to you guys.
Work evil, is that the no? That's not the message. Hang on. No, sorry, I'm messing with you. That's where you and I think probably diverge a little bit. And this is interesting for me, because to me, the whole point of this is that it's got to come from individuals, and therefore I'm not in the business of starting massive organizations. This is what we're talking about before the break. I'm not here to start a massive truth movement organization, but I would be thrilled to see other individuals stepping up to the plate as you've done, as I'm in the process of working towards doing. And I think one of the things for me is I look at the way that I got woken up. And as we were talking about when I first came on at the start of this hour, it was feeling that something had touched me, feeling that in some way the government, as silly as it was, I mean, it was water restrictions, and looking at other kids and feeling their loss for not having, you know, run through sprinklers in their front lawns and stuff. I mean, how silly a thing to get woken up over, and yet that for me, that was the beginning. That's what started it. And I guess for me, waking people up isn't about telling them, it's not about telling them that the world is a lie and that everything that they believe is not true. It's about trying to find that one thing where they will have the scales fall off their eyes and go, oh, the government's actually made my life worse in this particular way. A big one at the moment is the bushfires that we've suffered here in Australia. We had a terrible tragedy a few years ago in bushfires. I believe it was 174 people dead in a matter of 2 or 3 days. And the reason why the bushfires were so unbelievably uncontrollable was, one, because the weather was as harsh and severe as it was, and we'd had the drought and so forth. There were some fundamental things that we did not have control over. But two, our Department of Sustainability and Environment, for so-called environmental reasons, had stopped backburning and had allowed the fuel load sitting on the forest floor to exceed the highest classification that they had. They had three classifications for fuel load: low, medium, high. The fuel loads that were on the forest floor, or on the floor of the bush when those bushfires came through, I think it was 2009, but don't quote me on that. I haven't looked that up. I wasn't, researching it to prepare to talk about it today. But when those bushfires came through, we had Black Saturday, and all those people were killed. The fuel loads on the forest floor were in excess of the highest level of the high rating and had been allowed to accumulate to that point by our own Department of Sustainability and Environment. Now, not only had they not done their job and controlled fuel loads, they also made it illegal for people to collect firewood. You could not, even if you lived there, you couldn't walk out off your own property, half a kilometre into the bush and start dragging massive logs in to chop up firewood. Not allowed to do it. You'll get fined. But that's here's like the real kicker.
That's like freaking medieval. What's next? Prima Nocta?
I'll tell you what's next. There was a gentleman in Kinglake, a town which is quite close to my heart. I'm a motorbike rider, and Kinglake is a rural town up in the hills north of Melbourne. Fantastic bakery up there, and a lot of like-minded people like myself love to get out on the motorbike, and we'll finish, or towards the end of a good day of riding, we'll pull into Kinglake and have a meat pie at the bakery and just sort of sit and enjoy. And that was one of the hardest hit towns when the bushfires came through. In fact, I was in Kinglake about a half an hour before the bushfires hit. We didn't know the bushfires were coming. And I was on my way home from a motorcycle track day up in a bit further north of there, and we had no idea what was about to happen. And I just rode home as I normally did, and then watched the news that night and found out that the bakery where I'd stopped and had a pie earlier that day was still standing, but the entire town around it had been decimated, and a lot of people had lost their lives. Anyway, a gentleman living in Kinglake applied to the council to cut down a tree because he felt that tree was a fire threat to his house. Now, bear in mind, we get told constantly that it's our responsibility to prepare for fire. Every homeowner's responsibility is to make sure that their property is as prepared as it can be. He turned around and said, "Here is a tree that is on my property that is a fire hazard to my house, and I want to cut it down." Now, firstly, ask yourself the question, why in the world did he have to apply to the council in the first place? It's a tree on his property. That's just madness. Anyway, the council then had the audacity to say, "No, you can't cut down a tree on your own property." He said, "Well, STFU, this is about safety for me and my family. I'm cutting it down." He cut down the tree. They fined him $50,000. That's not a typo. That's not a mistake. 50,000 Australian dollars for cutting down a tree on his own property. Now, where a councillor, a local council, gets the idea that it has that kind of power, I do not know. But here's the kicker. Other people on his street likewise applied to cut down trees and were likewise told that they couldn't. They didn't after what happened to him, the $50,000 fine. When Black Saturday came, you couldn't write a script like this because it would seem too cliched. But when Black Saturday came, one house on that street was left standing. Guess whose it was? It was his. Now, if you wrote a script like that, people would go, "Oh, no, it wouldn't happen like that. It's too cliche. It's too perfect." No, that's how it happened. One house was left. It was his. The real tragedy, some of his neighbours died in their homes, having not cut down those trees because a councillor told them they couldn't. So I'm pushing that one fairly hard around here at the moment because we just had another raft of bushfires, a few fatalities, nowhere near as bad as last time, but nonetheless, worse than what it could have and should have been had individuals been permitted to actually do what they needed to do to protect themselves and their families.
I reckon those councillors should probably face charges or go down for manslaughter or something.
I wholeheartedly agree, but in order for someone to prosecute that, they would have to expose themselves to the risk of being prosecuted for their own ineptitude, for their own mistakes. The system does not want to prosecute the system.
The fox doesn't want to, criticise other foxes.
No, exactly, exactly. I mean, that could come back to bite them in a big way. So this is the sort of thing that I get very passionate about because it's a chance for people to stand there and go, "Hang on, the government did make that worse than it could have been." And maybe for them, that'll be the water crisis. as you know, what the water crisis was for me. Maybe that'll be that one little thing. It's an easy sell. I don't have to try and convince people about New World Order and Agenda 21 or any of the other, the big stuff. Let them discover that stuff for themselves. But I want to get people to that point where in their gut, they accept for the first time in their life that the government actually wasn't acting in their best interests, that the government actually wasn't there for them, but it was there for itself. And that is the beginning of the process. And if I can start that, then fantastic.
Now, you're familiar with the phrase, all roads lead to Rome. And yes. What I've found is it doesn't matter what conspiracy or what form of corruption or what thing happens to you. Like me personally, I was arrested and was going to go to jail for up to 8 years for possession of 13 grams of cannabis.
Wow.
Okay, like yeah. it gets treated as badly as manslaughter. So I got woken up due to the tyranny of the drug war, and then it just kind of spilled over and went into all these other sectors. And so the same can be true of anybody else who wakes up in any other way. I think.
Let me put it to you this way: for me, I have never smoked cannabis. I've never taken any drug that is currently listed as illegal. I barely take Panadol. I've only recently started drinking coffee with caffeine. Like I am as drug free as you could possibly get someone to be. But like these councillors who thought they had the right to tell someone what they could do with a tree on their own property, what gives a government the right to tell you what you can and can't put into your own body? I don't see where that right came from. Now, a lot of people, in order to excuse that right, they talk about harm argument. They talk about, oh, but it's bad. You know, hard drugs are bad. People go to hospital. We have to pay for their medical care. And I sort of say, well, that's a fantastic argument against socialized medicine. I shouldn't have to pay for other people's stupidity, but nor should the government be stepping in and throwing people in jail for their own stupidity or for their own decisions. I know a lot of people believe that cannabis is actually good and can be used for a whole lot of things. I personally am not on the same page with that. But I am completely on the same page when it comes to your right to choose what you do with your own body and what you do and don't put into it. I do not see how a government thinks it has the authority to tell you what you can and can't put into your own mouth. That is just – and again, if that's what begins the process for someone, fantastic. All the better.
Mm-hmm. Well, the proviso was, of course, I was selling it. And
yeah. Scum of
and other people voluntarily came up to me. Asked for it, and I provided it for them, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wasn't forcing it down anybody. I wasn't selling to kids or anything like that. And if you tried to look for the harm that was caused to any of those individuals, it's like, well, hold on a second. Even if there was harm caused by those individuals, they got themselves into it. Ain't my fault. But this mentality that we're talking about here, I don't know, it's kind of like grandiose scale mollycoddling. Have you ever seen children who mummy does everything for them and they've gotten to the point where they're like 14 years old and they still can't tie their own shoelaces kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely frightening. There's a reason why we call it the nanny state. It's, you know, it's just the perfect cliche for it.
You know what's unfortunate, Topher, is I reckon we could keep talking about this for quite a while, but we've come to the end of the show.
Yeah, I know. It happens to me every week as well.
Yeah.
So much to say, so little time.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have you back on about the 27th of February for the United States audience. So that'll be good. We'll 2 hours, a bit of an expansion on that one. See you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.